office and explained to his staff that he would drive himself back to the hotel and then go visit his parents. They assumed the director's parents were home in Pyongyang, and he did nothing to dispel their assumption. While the director was taking care of this and other matters, Yao was in the geology lab with Helen Powers. They were alone, which was a good thing for them both, because Adam decided he would speak English. He didn't think she would think much of her chances if he told her he was a Chinese spy. She put together on her own who he worked for the moment he dropped his accent fully. "Dr. Powers, do you really want to get out of here?"
"I... you're American?"
"You tell anyone and I will be killed. You will be suspected at best and stood up against a wall right next to me at worst. You understand that, don't you?"
"Well, the blazes, would I tell anyone? You think I like these people? They're mad bastards."
"Huang and I are leaving, and if you stay, you will be in danger.
Let me get my purse."
Adam drove behind the wheel of a silver Pyonghua Pronto, Huang's 7-passenger SUV. Huang sat next to him in the front, and in the middle row sat his wife and 2 small children. They were all confused, but they were quiet, because they were obedient, and Huang told them everything was fine. Dr. Helen Powers sat in the 3rd row, doing her best to keep her red hair under a black cap so it didn't draw any more attention to the vehicle than necessary as they drove through the North Korean backcountry. As they neared the cottage, Huang spoke in Mandarin to Adam.
"Go you,"
Huang said it softly. Adam turned to Huang. He wasn't sure what the Korean was talking about, or even if he'd heard correctly. "Go you" meant dogs in Mandarin. He knew the Korean word, so he checked.
"Ge?" "Yes."
Huang continued in Mandarin.
"Dogs."
"What about dogs?"
"You said Choi would have me shot."
"You are wrong. He wouldn't have had me shot. He would have fed me to starving dogs." Adam turned back to the road. He squeezed the steering wheel tighter.
"We've heard about that. Most of our analysts thought it was just an exaggerated rumor."
"No rumor. General Gong of Foreign Intelligence was killed in this manner last year."
"Mother of God.
How do you know?"
"Because General Ri told me.
He was there." After a pause, he said, "Ri killed himself and his family, so they would not suffer the same fate." Yao shuddered. He wished like hell he had some way to talk to Acrid Herald Control and let them know he was on the way. They said they'd be watching from above, which meant satellites, probably the KH-12 that Adam knew monitored North Korea. But now that he was picking up strays along the way, he could only hope the helicopter they were sending was big enough to handle everyone. They arrived at the cottage at 7 p.m. It wasn't remote at all, just one of hundreds of cookie-cutter little homes with postage-stamp fenced yards that overlooked the coastline in a massive complex. A cool wind blew in from Korea Bay, and the moon provided enough light for Huang to pick out the right unit. While many of North Korea's citizens starved, a few thousand elite owned vacation cottages. Huang's family was one of the haves, and while it didn't look like much to Yao, in this country it was an unfathomable luxury to 99% of the population. Adam said,
"Okay, just like we planned it. Quickly. Don't answer questions. Just get them moving. No luggage. Just the clothes on their backs and any medicine they need in the next 24 hours.
Huang just nodded. Everyone stayed in the vehicle except for Huang, who climbed out and went to the front door. He knocked and waited. Adam rolled down the driver's side window. He was only 25 feet from Huang at the door, and he wanted to listen to how Huang told his presumably elderly parents that they had to leave right this minute. An elderly man and woman stepped out and onto the stoop in front of the door. Huang's father put his hand on his son's shoulder. He leaned on unsteady legs. Adam thought the old man was just using his son for balance, but quickly he realized he was leaning close to his son to say something.
"What is it, father? We must hurry."
This worried Adam. How would the old man know they were going somewhere? The father mumbled something. Adam couldn't understand, and he saw Huang couldn't make it out either.
"What, father?"
"Disgrace. You are a disgrace. You bring dishonor on us."
Adam was moving in a half second, opening the car door, leaping out into the little driveway, running up to the door.
"Huang!"
The old lady shouted now.
"The Daewon Su will have his revenge for your deceit."
She threw a bony, weak fist at her son's face. It glanced off him, but he reacted as if he had been decked by a heavyweight.
"Mother!"
Huang shouted in shock. Adam pushed between them as both the old man and the old lady began throwing blows. Most of them hit Adam on his back. None of them hurt at all.
"Let's go," he said in Mandarin.
"Traitor!"
Huang Senior shrieked.
"Working with the Zhongguogui!"
"The Chinese." Yao saw the tears on Huang's face, the incomprehension that his own parents had turned against him. But he wouldn't leave. Adam shouted,
"They turned you in! We have to get out of here!"
Huang just stood on the little stoop. His parents were still within arm's reach, and they swung and scratched at him. Adam fought them both off with one arm, but he'd taken a blow just over the eye, and the old couple seemed to grow stronger with adrenaline. If he had his way, he'd deck them both, just drop them with a couple of jabs. But he knew that would just anger Huang and jeopardize a mission that already had enough going against it.
"Forget them!"
he shouted at Huang. He saw Huang's wife climbing out of the SUV now. He yelled at her in Korean.
"Get back in the car!"
"No."
Huang cried openly now, his face tight, eyes squinted, but tears managing to find their way through and down his face.
"Huang!"
Adam shouted.
"Your children, Min He and Du Ho, won't stand a chance if we don't run right now."
The 54-year-old Korean turned to Adam, opened his eyes a little. Finally, he turned and started back to the car. Adam took one last look at the parents. They were impossibly small and rail-thin, but the anger in their eyes made them look like wild animals. Huang walked across the driveway, his parents running after him. Adam got behind Huang to where he couldn't see him, then spun around with his fist balled and high. He had no plans on beating an 80-year-old couple, even though he thought it likely their actions might well get him, this family, and the Australian geologist killed. He jumped back behind the wheel and jammed the vehicle in reverse, backed out of the little dirt drive and put it in gear. He stomped on the accelerator, and the four-cylinder shot dirt and fishtailed, then raced on. Headlights appeared on the tiny road ahead of him, multiple sets of high beams. Adam kept racing right toward them as fast as he could, hoping like hell they would move out of the way. At 20 yards he could tell they were troop trucks, so he swerved off the road and began crashing through the low fences of the tiny postage stamp yards in front of the cottages. One after the other, he smashed through wooden and wire fences, then bounced up into gardens, back down the other side, and then crashed through the next stretch of fence. As they passed the trucks, he heard the booming cracks of rifle fire. Everyone in the SUV screamed for their lives, but the vehicle bounced on, reached the end of the neighborhood, and peeled hard to the right, accelerating down a hill.
"You called your parents. You told them we were coming. Didn't you?"
Adam asked. Huang just nodded, tears streaming down his face. Behind him, his wife screamed at him, and his kids were on the verge of hyperventilation. Dr. Powers was doing everything she could to calm the children, but she didn't speak their language, so it was an impossible task. A pair of helicopters flew low overhead.
"Hold on!"
Adam said it in Korean, then jacked the wheel to the right. The mud and rocks slapped the undercarriage of the vehicle as it bounced down a hill in the dark. He shouted to Huang,
"Where does this road go?"
"It leads to a stream, straight ahead at the bottom of the hill."
"How deep?"
Huang thought.
"At this time of the year, it is very shallow, almost dry in places."
Adam didn't much like his plan, but he felt he had no choice. He reached up and flipped off the headlights.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm hoping they don't have night vision."
He fought the strong urge to turn the lights back on, and the even stronger urge to slow down. Finally, he felt the hill bottom out, and he turned to the right, away from the ocean to his left. He slowed a little, but kept as much speed as he dared. The SUV bounced wildly over the rocks in the dry stream bed. Adam saw the lights of the helicopters in the distance as the SUV drove on. The helos would follow the road, looking for the SUV, and as long as Adam and the others stayed at the bottom of the little valley, moving in the dry stream bed, and as long as there was cover from the flora above them, they would be safe.
"Are you okay?"
Adam asked Huang. The North Korean was still crying, but he nodded distractedly. Though Huang's family was in the car with him, Adam saw that the man felt totally alone after his parents turned on him. Adam said,
"You had to do this. Troy was going to kill everyone in your family."
Huang turned and pointed at Adam angrily.
"You are an inferior Jungkook-hui. You do not say the family name of the Daewansu."
"Christ," Yao thought. "This one is brainwashed like all the others."
Chapter 73. President of the United States Jack Ryan wasn't fit to travel, especially halfway around the world, but he was doing it anyway. The trip was against the advice of his doctors, his wife, and anyone with a shred of knowledge of broken bones and soft tissue damage and the dangers of exhaustion. But Ryan was the president, and he overruled them all. He'd been making his calls to world leaders 2 days earlier when President Ling of China had offered to meet with him at any time to discuss the disintegrating relations with North Korea. Ryan sensed that the offer was more than just the typical platitudes that came along with telling someone he was glad he'd not been murdered. So Ryan told Ling he would very much like to get together in China for a private talk. Ling had said any time, so Ryan proposed 3 days hence. The translators had to triple-check that the American president was talking about arriving in Beijing on Saturday. This Saturday. Within hours of the phone conversation, Mary Pat Foley all but burst into Ryan's hospital room to tell him an Iranian bomb maker had been captured alive near Mexico City, and he had details of an interesting trip to Pyongyang he'd made just prior to his attack on the presidential motorcade. With incontrovertible proof North Korea was involved, the Ryan administration leaked a rumor to take the heat off the Mexican government. Ryan ordered Justice and DNI to hold most of the details they had, because he wanted to exploit the information at a time and place of his own choosing. It was statecraft, and Ryan figured if he had to get blown up, he might as well get something out of it for America in the process. Ryan and Foley decided Ryan would use this trip to Beijing to pass the intelligence about North Korea's involvement directly to Chinese President Ling. Ling would be terrified. He would know any action taken by the United States against Pyongyang would destabilize the Korean Peninsula, and he would worry about a war, a refugee crisis, and his own country's exposure to guilt by association, since even though China and North Korea were in the middle of their worst relationship of the past 70 years, North Korea still had no closer friend than its large communist neighbor to the north. Ryan wanted Ling to be scared about what actions the U.S. might take for retribution. The more concerned China was about threats to its own national interests, the more inclined they would be to partner with the United States against the criminal regime in Pyongyang. Then Mary Pat read President Ryan in on Acrid Herald. What had started out as an opportunity to learn about a North Korean mineral processing facility had turned into a major intelligence coup. Right now, Hwang Min-ho was on the run in North Korea, attempting to defect, he thought, to the Chinese. If this worked, Ryan knew, he would have someone who could reveal to the world how North Korea's mineral wealth was being used, not for the good of its own people, but instead to build up their nuclear missile arsenal. If it all worked as planned, if Hwang made it out and revealed what he knew, then Ryan knew his meeting with President Ling tomorrow would be an opportunity for the two superpowers to work together on a mutual problem. In the meantime, Ryan just wished he wasn't such an invalid at the moment. Although he could walk and talk, his left hand was in a cast and his right arm was in a sling. With all the attendants at his disposal, there was no one around here in this office on Air Force One, and he needed to scratch his damn nose. And this put him in an exceptionally foul humor. Adam Yao drove the North Korean-made SUV slowly down the long straight dirt road at midnight. He went all the way to the end, some mile and a half from the main highway, until he reached the poultry farm. Here he turned off the engine and listened carefully. Nothing. A few chickens clucking in a coop, the sound of wind through the pine trees thick on the adjacent hillside, but no sound of helicopters racing in. Adam was scared now, but the kids behind him were asleep. Hwang and his wife spoke softly back and forth. She was frightened still, but Hwang seemed to be doing a better job of calming her than himself, because he appeared to be scared shitless. Min-hee, the 9-year-old girl, sat up suddenly and looked around, and soon Do-ho did the same. Within seconds, Adam heard it as well. It was a high-pitched buzzing, very faint, but growing in volume. It didn't sound to Adam like an airplane, not even a small one, and it was definitely not a helicopter. Still, he told everyone to get out. Once they were on the dirt road, they heard it better. It was definitely a propeller, and it hummed almost like a lawnmower. Adam saw it first, but he didn't know what he was looking at. A winged apparition moved low over the trees, darker than the night sky behind it. Then Hwang saw it. What is that? It passed directly overhead, then banked tightly and lined up on the road upon which they stood. Adam said, "It's a UAV. A drone." It was a Predator, which was unquestionably American, but it was doubtful Hwang or his wife would know this. As it neared, Adam was glad to see there was no U.S. flag on the side. "What is it doing here?" Hwang asked. "I have absolutely no idea." Do-ho pointed into the sky.
"There is another one."
Both Predators landed on the road, one after the other, and then taxied to within 50 feet of Adam Yao. To himself he said, "You've got to be kidding." It occurred to him there might be a message or a piece of equipment on the aircraft, so he walked over to the closer one. He saw a large basket hanging from the bottom. It was the size of a love seat, and it had a pneumatic hatch with a marking that read, "Pull." Adam did so, and the device separated like a clamshell, the bottom lowering down about a foot and a half. Adam looked inside. There was LED lighting glowing to help him. He saw two sleeping bags and a satellite phone. He snatched the phone and saw that it was blinking. There was already a call coming through. Adam moved away from Hwang and his family and whispered,
"Avalanche."
"Hello, Avalanche. You were speaking with the Tactical Operations Center on board the USS Freedom. This line is being broadcast to Op Center Tidal Wave, and we are watching you from a KH-12.
"Understood.
What is the status of your cargo? We see 3 adults and 2 children in addition to yourself."
"I have 6 packs total. 3 adults, including precious cargo, and 2 children.
"Who is the other adult?" I had to bring out an Australian woman, Dr. Powers. She was compromised and in danger. There was a pause. Copy. Is this basket what I think it is? It is a personnel recovery device. Place the adult male in one basket with the male child. Put the two adult women together with the female child. We didn't know about the Australian. We are expediting the backup UAV to your pose, but be advised you'll be waiting there 5 mics. Adams spoke even softer now, so Huang and his wife could not hear, although they did not speak English. Is this shit gonna work? Affirmative, Avalanche. Those UAVs are top secret. Codename Freebird. They are tested at 300 pounds per aircraft, well over the weight requirement needed. The baskets are not pressurized, so the ride will be low and a little bumpy, but it won't be too bad. Oh, okay. Any chance I can squeeze in? Unless your new friend weighs less than 45 pounds, I do not recommend it. The aircraft becomes unstable above 325 pounds. Adam started to speak, but the male voice told him to wait. After a few seconds, he came back on the line, his voice more agitated. Be advised, Avalanche. We are monitoring military helicopters moving into your sector. 12 minutes out at current speed. Get that cargo on board, seal the hatch, and go find some cover. We'll do the rest, sir. Okay. He was more resolute this time with his reply, not because he now felt much better about flying in the Freebird, but rather because now that he knew DPRK helos were inbound, he felt much worse about standing around here pondering his options. He ran over to Huang and spoke in Mandarin. Quickly, you and your family will fly in these airplanes.
Those aren't airplanes.
The man did have a point, Adam conceded to himself, but he knew he had to appear steadfast. They are perfectly safe. We do this all the time.
Where are the pilots?
Adam would have said the pilots were sitting safe and comfortable, maybe thousands of miles away, because he didn't like this idea one bit. But he needed Huang to comply. So instead he said, you'll meet them when they land. These are remote-controlled UAVs.
I don't know. Daewon Su's helicopters will be here in 10 minutes. Do you know what will happen if the army catches you and your family?
Adam knew his argument was convincing, but he was surprised by the quick 180. Huang said,
we should go now.
Exactly. The children were actually the easiest part of the equation. They let Adam pick them up with no complaints. He placed Duho into one predator, and then Huang climbed in behind him. Adam put Min He into the other predator, and then Dr. Powers climbed in along with Mrs. Huang. There was room for one more child in Huang's aircraft, but there was not enough room for a CIA officer. Adam pushed the buttons to close the two baskets. He wanted to say good luck, but decided against it. Instead, still in Mandarin, he said, see you in a little while. The first UAV taxied around, facing away from the direction of the approaching helicopters, and began accelerating up the straight road. The second turned and followed, not 100 yards behind. They climbed into the air one after the other. Adam felt the squeeze of tension in his stomach as they rose toward the green hill. They disappeared into the night in under a minute. He heard a voice on the sat phone, which he had lowered while watching the extraction. Repeat last, Freedom? Be aware. Third UAV approaching from south. Get off the road so it can land.
Copy that.
Adam ran over to stand next to the SUV, and he listened for the arriving Predator. When he heard it, he could tell it was flying a lot faster than the others, because the pitch was much higher. The aircraft banked over the hill next to the road, lined up on final approach, and increased its descent. And then it exploded in a fireball. Adam shielded his eyes from the light and shouted into the sat phone,
Freedom! You just lost the UAV!
After a quick pause, the reply came. Roger, Avalanche. Inbound helos took it out with an air-to-air missile. You need to get out of there now! Adam dove into the SUV and turned the engine over. He stomped on the gas and raced up the road. Two attack helicopters came over the hill on his right, swooping down at nap-of-the-earth height. They flew over Adam, then banked around hard and came back in his direction. He floored it. As he accelerated up the road, the two helos passed on a gun run. Shells rained down on the road right in front of him, but they landed long. Adam knew he wouldn't survive another pass. He had a half mile before getting to the highway, and they could pick him off there just as easily. He had to get out of the SUV and into the trees. He pushed the engine as fast as the Pronto would go on the straight dirt road, then he popped the transmission into neutral. He opened his door and dove out into the low grass by the road. The SUV continued on. Adam tumbled end over end, slamming his knee into a rock as he bounced on the earth. As soon as he stopped rolling, he climbed to his feet and limped into the hillside forest. He heard the helos fire again at the vehicle, and then he heard a huge explosion. The SUV had taken a hit to the gas tank, and now it burned in the road behind him. He hoped like hell no one would look for him for the length of time it took them to discover no bodies inside the burning SUV. Even though he was injured now, he was starting to feel very lucky, considering how close he had come to death. But then he realized he'd left the sat phone in the SUV. He dropped down into the grass, pounding the ground in frustration. It was more than 20 miles to the Yalu River. China was on the other side, and it was hardly welcoming, but it was all he had to shoot for. He pulled himself back to his feet and hobbled up the hill, blood running down his leg. Chapter 74. The two Freebirds flew out over Korea Bay, then south to Incheon. There the UAVs were shadowed by a pair of U.S. Navy Seahawk helos in case of mechanical problems over water. The UAVs had no problems, however, and landed at Osan Air Base without incident 95 minutes later, marking the first and second operational use of a Predator Freebird. When the baskets were opened by CIA personnel at the airfield, everyone was alive, awake, and aware, although Huang and his daughter had both vomited repeatedly in transit. Huang dropped to the tarmac, then helped his son out of the basket. Once Duho was on firm ground, Huang ran over to his wife and daughter and hugged them both. It was only then that he realized he was surrounded by Americans. 20 minutes later, he sat in a conference room in an administrative building at the airfield. He'd been given a change of clothes and a bottle of water, but no one had spoken directly to him until an American woman in her 60s entered the room with a Korean woman wearing the uniform of the United States Air Force. The Korean woman informed Huang that she would be his translator. He nodded, but his eyes were on the other woman in front of him. "I want to speak to someone in charge." The translator relayed this in English. Mary Pat Foley replied, "I am the director of all the combined intelligence agencies for the United States of America. Will I do?" Huang looked to the translator, then back to Mary Pat. "Yes, you will do." She spent 20 minutes establishing who Huang was, what he knew, and what access he had. Afterward, she left the room for an hour. When she came back, she said, "Here are our terms. We want every piece of information you have, everything about your operation. If we are satisfied with what you give us, in return you will receive political asylum in the United States. If you would like to relocate to South Korea, I feel confident we can see that this happens, but that is ultimately up to the South Koreans." Huang nodded slowly. He considered asking if he could go to China, but he did not. "I agree to your terms." "Good. Let's begin with your debrief immediately." He was surprised by this. "I am very tired. Could we begin later, after I rest?" Foley shook her head. "Absolutely not. Lives are at stake, Mr. Huang. Your wife and your children can rest. You and I have a lot of work to do. Huang sighed. National Geospatial Intelligence Analyst Annette Brawley had spent the first part of her day looking over train cars in Pyongyang, searching for evidence that the North Koreans were moving any of their mining equipment north, salvaging parts from copper or coal mines with the intention of transporting them up to the strip mine at Chungju. She hadn't found anything interesting on the North Korean rail network, but she was holding out hope that some new sat images due in the next 5 minutes might give her a clearer picture of the mine itself. She glanced at the mine and looked up from her computer monitor to see Colonel Mike Peters storming her way.
Hi, Mike.
Come with me.
Sorry, boss, I can't go right now. We're about to get the latest Chungju images from NRO.
This isn't a request. You and me have been ordered to go to the bubble on 5.
Holy crap, Brawley said, standing up from her desk as she did so. Are we in trouble?
Dunno. I know we will be if we aren't there in about 2 minutes. Brawley and Peters were led into the secure communications room, known as the bubble. They sat down in front of a monitor that displayed the image of an empty desk. Behind it was a sign that said Osan AB. After a minute, they saw some moving shadows off to the side of the desk on the monitor. The two NGA employees looked at each other in confusion. After a minute more, Peters uttered a tentative, "Hello?" Almost instantly, Mary Pat Foley, the Director of National Intelligence, sat down at the desk. Her eyes were to a point off-screen, and it quickly became apparent someone was talking to her. She nodded, then looked at the monitor in front of her. She seemed rushed and concerned, and this made Annette Brawley absolutely terrified. Foley said, "Okay. Sorry, I don't know your names." Peters spoke for both himself and his employee. "Madam Director, I'm Colonel Michael Peters of NGA, and this is Annette Brawley, an analyst in my office. How can we be of service?"
"Your desk has developed the information on the rare earth mineral mine and processing facility in Chungju, DPRK."
"Yes, Madam Director," Peters said. Brawley detected nervousness in her boss's voice. Someone off-camera spoke to Director Foley, and she nodded.
"I am told you, Ms. Brawley, know more about this area than anyone else in the U.S. intelligence community."
Brawley had no idea if that was true, because she had no idea what other operations were going on in that area. She only knew about the mines. She replied, "I have focused on the northwestern mountains and foothills of DPRK for over 2 years. Foley nodded. "What I am about to tell you both is code word classified." Brawley nodded slowly. She felt sweat dripping down the back of her neck. Foley said, "We had a CIA officer on the ground in Chungju. Last night he was compromised during extraction. Right now he is in the wind, and we think it is possible he is injured." Brawley's lips moved, forming the words, "Oh my God," although she made no sound. Peters asked, "Do we know anything about what type of vehicle he's driving?"
"He was in an SUV of local manufacture. That vehicle has been destroyed by helicopter gunfire."
"Was he inside?"
"Sigint says the North Koreans are tearing up the countryside looking for someone. We hope it's him. We were tracking him with a satellite, but we lost him after DPRK helicopters destroyed the vehicle he was traveling in. We caught a heat register of a lone individual nearby after the attack, but we lost the signature."
"No comms, I take it," Peters said.
"Unfortunately, we have no communication with him at this point. We do not know his location. All of his extraction options, it appears from NRO's and CIA's reading of the satellite images available to us, are closed off. We don't know what he can do, and we don't know what he will do."
Brawley nodded.
"We should have the newest daylight images in less than 5 minutes. If there has been anomalous police, government, or military activity in the area, maybe I can find evidence of it. Use that as a starting point to know where to look for..."
She searched for the term. The officer. Foley said, "The officer's code name is Avalanche. He is an American citizen of Chinese descent." Brawley raised a hand. "If we find him, or evidence of where he is there something that can be done for him?" Foley's lips tightened, a pained expression. "Frankly, Ms. Brawley, I have no idea. Our options are extremely limited. But if we can't even find Avalanche, I can guarantee he has no chance whatsoever." Brawley nodded. "I'll find him." She didn't know why she said it, but once it came out of her mouth, she knew she had to come through. Adam Yao pedaled the bike with his right leg while his left stuck out in front of him. The swelling in his knee made it impossible to bend his leg, so slow, painful, one-legged biking was all that was available to him. He'd stolen the bike in a tiny suburb of Sunshine City by picking the lock on a bike rack, and then he'd ridden as fast as he could with one leg, mostly on dirt roads, and even on fields and hillsides. It was slow going. He might have been averaging 3 miles an hour tops, but he had no choice but to push on. He knew his only chance was to get to and then over the Yalu River. Getting to it would be tough. There were patrols on the highways and in the little towns, and he had spent the early morning hours ducking helos that crisscrossed the sky. Once daylight came in a few hours, it would be even tougher for him. If he wasn't in a good hide sight by sunup, he wouldn't have a chance in hell. And getting over the Yalu would be even harder. There were bridges, but they would be well guarded. The current was known to be impossible to swim, and any ferry boats, even the kinds used by smugglers, would most likely be known to the North Korean government, and therefore monitored now that the DPRK knew there was an enemy agent in their area. His leg was bleeding from a gash next to the knee. He needed stitches for sure, and he needed to elevate it and apply pressure, but he'd done nothing more than tear off a piece of his shirt and tie it over the wound. It continued to pump blood, and Adam wondered how long it would take for him to weaken from the blood loss. Adam was a smart guy, which meant he knew he was fucked. But what choice did he have? He just kept pumping the pedal on the right side of the bike, up and down, trying to get as far north as possible before daylight. Annette Brawley sat in the bubble in front of the monitor that connected her via video conference to Osan Air Base in South Korea and looked at her laptop. Mary Pat Foley sat on the other end of the connection, a laptop in front of her as well, and together they looked at a series of satellite pictures resident on their computers. Annette could make notes on her computer with a stylus, and Mary Pat would immediately see the notations on her images. Annette said, "Look here. A police car, and several people standing around." "What is that?" "That's a bicycle rack outside an apartment building. This is on the outskirts of Sunshine, not far from where Avalanche disappeared. I think someone stole a bike. Theft in North Korea like that is highly rare, because stealing a bike over there will get you executed. My assumption is Avalanche took it as a means of transportation, and from here, he went north." "How do you know that?" "West is the ocean. East is the entire nation of North Korea. South is the majority of the military in pursuit of him. North is the Yalu River, but on the other side of that is China. He has bad options in each direction, but nothing will look more promising than north." Mary Pat said, "Okay, go on." "We estimate his rate on a bicycle on the back roads to be 7 miles an hour. I base this on the movements of other men around his age and their progress when moving north. Actually, the average is closer to 10, depending on the bicycle, but we know Avalanche would be avoiding checkpoints and population centers, so we shave off 30%. Annette Brawley moved the image far to the north, then enhanced the image even more. It was some sort of an open field, a dirt road running to the south of it. That much was plain. Foley saw nothing in the field. "What am I looking at?" "The fact that this is empty. This is at 7 a.m., well after the time we would expect him to arrive if he was coming here." Why do you think he would be coming here specifically? Brawley switched the image. Because of this. It was the same location as the last image, with one exception. Foley looked at the picture. Is that a bicycle? Lying in the field? It's a bicycle in a rice paddy, on its side. And it's not just any bicycle. This is at Kalmagi. They're made at Life Detention Settlement No. 25, up in North Hamgyong Province. It's the highest quality local brand used in North Korea. There's a waiting list for these bikes, 3 or 4 years, and that's if you're lucky and you have the money. I can't say no one in North Korea would ever leave a Kalmagi lying around like this, but I will say no one in this poor mountainous area would. And there's more. This showed up between 8 and 9 a.m., much later than we thought he would arrive, even considering his environment. What does that mean to you? Significant injury, Brawley said gravely. So, where is he now? If he had been captured, we would expect to see vehicle tracks leading into this rice paddy. I checked. The paddies aren't flooded, but the ground is very wet from the spring rains. Truck tires would remain for weeks this time of the year. Even if he was picked up by a group of men on foot, we would see some disturbance. But there's nothing. If he walked off, would we see that? No. The resolution won't pick up a single set of footprints. Brawley smiled. I wish. No, it won't even pick up the disturbance of one body going through waist-high foliage or crops. Even if it was hundreds of yards of trail, it's just too narrow and subtle to show up. So, I'll ask again, where is he? Brawley used the laser pointer to touch a crescent-shaped grove of trees at the edge of the Yalu River. The roof of a tiny fishing shack was apparent at one side, but there was no sign of life anywhere else in the area. I think he's in these trees. I've checked the Chinese side of the river, and it's crawling with border guards. I don't see indication that anything exciting is happening as far as they're concerned, so he hasn't crossed. That leaves these trees. If he is healthy enough to try it, he might be waiting for nightfall to cross. But there are whirlpools and relatively strong currents this time of year. How do we know that? There are links on Map of the World. Americans have traveled the Yalu and then reported it. Just adventure travelers in rafts and kayaks, not spooks. Crazy if you think about it, but there are some crazy folks out there and we benefit from them. If he does try to swim or float across, Brawley hesitated. If he tries, I don't think Avalanche will make it. Mary Pat Foley said, This is really incredible work, Miss Brawley. Thank you, Annette replied. I just wish I could do more for Avalanche. Someone else needs to do something for Avalanche now. If we get him out, it will be because of you. 1 hour later, Annette Brawley was shutting down her computer for the night. She wanted to get home to make dinner for Stephanie. Her daughter would complain about it, but Annette knew the best thing she could do to help Stephanie through her tumultuous teenage years, years made more tumultuous by the death of her father, was to be there for her, even if she didn't appreciate the effort. Just as she stood and reached for her purse, the phone on her desk rang. Maybe this would be Stephanie, letting her know she wouldn't be home for dinner. She liked to wait until right before her mom left work to tell her. Annette answered her phone. Brawley, please hold for the President of the United States. Excuse me? There was no response. Her heart skipped a beat, but quickly she came to her senses. Colonel Peters, that's not funny. I've got work to do. Just then the unmistakable voice of President Jack Ryan came over the line. She looked around the room, motioning frantically to two co-workers still in the office, but neither noticed her. Ms. Brawley, Jack Ryan here. She cleared her throat. Mr. President, quick question. In about 10 minutes I'm going to be sitting with the President of the People's Republic of China. It is crucial that I give him good information regarding the CIA asset on the ground in the DPRK. Director Foley told me your conclusions, and they sound solid to me, but I'm going to put you on the spot here. How certain are you that he's right where you say he is? Annette realized her hand was shaking the telephone receiver. She pushed it tighter against her ear. She looked at the picture of Ryan she kept on her desk. Mr. President, I believe he went into those woods, 100%. And I don't believe anyone has gone in to get him. Again, I'm 100% confident in that. The only unknown is whether or not he is in the Yalu River. I truly hope he is still in those trees, but the only way to know for sure is to go in there and look for him. The president's reply came quickly, like he was rushed. You've done some good work. I wish I'd had some of the technology you possessed back in my analyst days, but I know enough to know more noise doesn't necessarily mean more music. You've got a ton of things you have to work through, and I'm impressed.
Thank you, sir.
It's wonderful to be appreciated. I know what you mean. Thankless work most of the time. He paused. So, thanks.
I'm sorry about Mexico. Are you feeling better?
Every day. Gotta run. Goodbye. The line went dead in Annette Brawley's hand, and within seconds she began questioning whether or not the conversation had even taken place. Chapter 75. President Ryan had spent less than 90 minutes in direct talks with Chinese President Ling, but already he felt he had accomplished more substantive work than he had in his past 2 years of bilateral dealings with the often obstinate and sometimes belligerent superpower. He had not met the new president face to face until now, and he wanted to ascribe much of the progress of the past hour and a half to his good working relationship with the man, but he suspected Ling wasn't terribly different from most of the other high Chinese Communist Party officials that the party extrudes into leadership positions. No, the success of this meeting had much to do with the fact Ryan came bearing both threats and gifts. The first order of business had been to detail to the Chinese president North Korea's involvement in the attack in Mexico City. Ryan brought no evidence with him. This wasn't the type of meeting where two men would look over photos and witness statements together. Ryan instead offered to send Ling every shred of intelligence the U.S. had gleaned from Adil Zarif over the past 3 days. Ling was astonished, and Ryan was pleased to see the 70-year-old Chinese Communist Party leader seemed to be every bit as worried about how this would affect China as Ryan had hoped he would be. Ryan then delved into details about Choi's obsessive quest to obtain nuclear missiles that could reach the U.S. mainland. Again, President Ling's face registered the gravity of the threat this posed to his own nation. Ryan could see that Ling knew what was good for him and his country. He would play ball with America in the looming crisis. The last thing in the world he needed was a war between nuclear powers on his border, and Choi Ji-hoon's aggressive quest for intermediate-range missiles and his targeting of world leaders were leading the region inexorably toward war. With the threats laid out in stark terms, Ryan offered his gift. He told Ling of the defection of Huang Min-ho, the director of Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation. The man was in U.S. custody, but Ryan offered China access to him and the opportunity to put him on national television and radio. Huang was prepared to speak about how the North Korean supreme leader had initiated the process to squander many trillions of dollars worth of desperately needed riches for his nation by expelling Chinese miners, all because he wanted to obtain a nuclear weapons delivery vehicle that would reach to the U.S. It was an endeavor that might well have led to the destruction of the entire Korean peninsula in the process, and the citizens of North Korea needed to know about this. Ryan knew the Chinese had media, mostly radio broadcasts, that could reach into hundreds of thousands of homes in North Korea. Not to the proletariat. These people only had the government radio sets that blocked all but officially recognized channels. But to the elite of the nation, virtually all of whom listened to modified radios that allowed them to pick up Chinese transmissions, often translated into Korean for their benefit. Within hours, Huang could be on a flight to Beijing with an American contingent. It was crucial he spread the word about Chungju to the people of North Korea as soon as possible, because Choi had been showing his volatility. The impounding of his mining equipment, the accusations he was involved in the assassination plot, the capture of his ICBM technology, and now the news that his intelligence chief had committed suicide. Choi was a wounded animal, and everyone expected him to act as such. And Choi had lived down to these expectations. In the past day, he had launched 2 short-range rockets into the Sea of Japan and shelled a pair of South Korean islands. Ryan knew the only sure bet was for Choi to be deposed from within, and the best chance for an internal uprising was convincing the elite of the nation that Choi had adversely affected all of their fortunes with his reckless obsession with nuclear missiles. And on this, Ryan and Ling were on the same page. They both felt their nations would only benefit if Choi was knocked from power. Ryan explained to Ling he knew the rare earth mineral mine's value and its potential value to Ling's nation. If you could get your mining industry back inside North Korea, it would be a tremendous boon to your nation's economy. Ling nodded, then asked, "How do you propose we convince Choi to allow this, without offering him missiles that would reach your California?" Ryan said, "China has a lot of positive influence over North Korea. Huang's speech might force the hand of the people of the nation to sack Choi." "That is possible. We do maintain many friendly contacts with people in positions of power." Ryan knew this. And he knew the answer to the question he posed next, but he knew it only through intelligence intercepts from China. He couldn't reveal this, of course, so he played dumb. Ji-hoon's uncle, I forgot his name, he was the ambassador to China, wasn't he? Whatever happened to him? Ling nodded. "Choi Sang-yu. We had a most excellent relationship with him. His nephew thought the relationship was too good, unfortunately, so Ji-hoon threw Sang-yu in prison." Ryan said, "It sounds like it would benefit China if this man was put into power in place of Ji-hoon." Ling agreed. "This would be the best possible outcome." After a pause, he added, "Depending, of course, on his present health and condition. You might know there is an attempt to re-educate those in prison. Not so much in the internment camps, but still we would have to evaluate him to see if he could take over the reins of power." Ryan said, "If this works, you might just have to take your chances. God knows he'd be better than Ji-hoon in power." Ling nodded thoughtfully. "You make a fair point." Ryan felt like the matter was dealt with. Huang would tell the North Korean elite that China should be in North Korea operating the mineral mine, and that wouldn't happen with Choi Ji-hoon in Ryongsong. Ryan switched gears suddenly. "Mr. President, there is another matter I need to discuss with you." "Unrelated?" "No, it's related. I would like to ask for some help. A citizen of my country is at present in North Korea. He is wounded, and it is critical we retrieve him." Ling listened to the translation, then asked, "Do you mean to tell me you have an American secret agent inside North Korea?" Ryan shrugged a little. "I am not prepared to say what the man's occupation is, but I hope you will appreciate the fact I refuse to lie to you." The president of China nodded slightly. "What is it you want?" "He is less than a kilometer from your border on the southern side of the Yalu River." "You are asking us to open our border crossing?" No, Mr. President. I am asking more than that. I am asking you to send some men in to get him. I am afraid what you are asking is out of the question. Despite the other matter to which we have just agreed, it is important for my country to maintain good and open relations with the DPRK. The potential for scandal in this matter is too great. The success of the first matter depends on the positive resolution of the second. The president of China turned to his translator and had him repeat himself. Ryan saw the man was confused by the wording, but he let him figure it out on his own. Finally, President Ling spoke, and the translator turned it into English. Do you mean to say the entire deal depends on this one man? Ryan did not hesitate. Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. It is in both of our nation's interests that this man is rescued alive. Ling was still astonished, but Ryan could see the gears turning in his head. The man saw an opportunity. If I agree to your request, I would like the opportunity for my intelligence officials to sit with this individual for a short interview. Ryan had been ready for this. The information he has is related to the issue at hand, nothing more. Be that as it may, I request, it is likely this man is gravely injured. I want him delivered to us here in Beijing. I will delay my departure, if necessary. If you do that, you have my personal assurance that an interview will be granted, provided he is in condition to give an interview, and only if my own people are allowed to be present during the interview. Ryan smiled. I expect this man might be very confused by everything. Ling asked, when do we need to rescue your agent? Ryan said, within the hour would be ideal, Mr. President. Ling just stared at his translator in shock. Chapter 76. Adam Yao lay in a thick copse of trees alongside the Yalu River, some 50 yards from the gravel road behind him. He heard trucks passing on the road back and forth, over and over, for most of the day. They couldn't see him. He was well hidden, but he knew that as soon as the army thought to dismount some troops to check the woodline, he would have to crawl to the river or lie here and await capture. And the river was too cold to ford, especially in his weakened state. Adam's knee was swollen like a grapefruit, and the huge gash was showing signs of infection just 24 hours after he dove out of the racing SUV. He had crawled the last 50 yards through a muddy rice paddy after he fell off the bicycle, and an hour earlier, when he tried to stand up, he had been unable to put any weight on the leg at all. He knew he wasn't going anywhere. It had been a bone-chilling and wretched evening, and he told himself he was ready to die. Freezing to death had always seemed so awful those few times in his life he'd ever thought about it. But now he found himself accepting his fate. At peace with it. Occasionally he thought he heard voices, never right on top of him, but certainly on the road, and perhaps even on boats passing on the Yalu River. He'd not understood any of the words, and after a while he started to wonder if his mind was not just playing tricks on him. Though he had heard the footfalls of individual men traveling on the road far below him, he did not hear the men in white at all until they were right on top of his position. He opened his eyes suddenly, aware of a presence close by, and he saw a group of armed men in white snow camouflage surrounding him here in the trees. It was too dark to tell anything else about them, but Adam assumed they were North Korean special forces. One of the men knelt down at his head while two more began working on his leg wound. The others, Adam saw, had taken up positions in the woods, their guns up in defense of him. What the hell was going on? In Mandarin, the man at his head said, Yao? How did they know his name? He shook his head. Wu,
No. Your country sent us. I don't believe you. Believe whatever you want. We are putting you on a stretcher and taking you over the river into China.
And Adam Yao just let them do it. He was in no position to argue.
Edward Riley stood on the fifth-floor rooftop of the apartment building across from Mai Phai Luang Chiang Rai International Airport in Chiang Rai, Thailand. With his binoculars in hand, he looked over the entire length of the tarmac, his eyes wide to take in the scant electric lighting. His binoculars were all but useless in the evening darkness. Where are they? They were supposed to be here hours ago. Once he was clear of immediate danger in Mexico, Riley had contacted Oscar Robles and told him he was still in play. He exaggerated his abilities and influence, and he asked Robles what he needed to do to prove he was still an asset to the operation. Riley had been almost surprised when Robles answered him, giving him the specifications of the froth flotation tanks, relaying the size and weight of the equipment, and filling him in on the special logistical problems involved in moving the huge industrial devices into North Korea. Now Riley was here in Thailand, and he had moved mountains to accomplish the one thing the North Koreans and Robles had not been able to do for themselves. In the past 5 days, Riley had played every last card in his deck. He'd used contacts, made deals, traded on old friendships, and called in every last favor he'd ever been owed by anyone. With this intangible currency, he'd made it out of Mexico, over to Asia, and he'd negotiated with Russian cargo companies and Thai businessmen. If he could pull this off, he could show both Robles and Pyongyang that he was worth the risk and an asset to their lucrative enterprise. Though compromised to the Americans, wanted as an accessory after the fact to the damnable thing that happened in Mexico City, he still could come through with the goods, and they would keep him under their wing. He'd arranged for a pair of Russian Antonov cargo aircraft to land at the airport here, and once they arrived, he'd only have to contact Robles, who was trying to secure the delivery of a new set of froth tanks that were on the water from Brazil. If the planes showed up as arranged, Riley could fly the bloody equipment into North Korea and bypass the Americans and their blockade. But so far, the fucking Russians hadn't shown. He'd work the phones. He'd make sure the tanks were on the ship and on the way, and he'd make sure the payment from the North Koreans made it to the seller. But if the Russians in their cargo planes didn't make it to Thailand, then this deal was dead in the dirt. He tried the binoculars again. Nothing. Where are those bloody planes? He lowered his binoculars and turned to head back to the stairs. He stopped suddenly when he saw a man standing there in the low light, 40 feet away. Who are you? Someone who's come a long way for this. Riley did not recognize the man, though he could tell he was American. Riley didn't have a gun, but the other man showed no hint of a weapon either. FBI? The man shook his head. Who then? My name is Jack. Meant nothing to Riley. A friend of Chavez. Oh. A friend of Veronica's. What? Riley thought about running for the stairwell, but this man looked prepared to stop him. He could just put down his head and charge forward, throw punches, and hope for the best. But Riley wasn't any kind of fighter. What is it you want? I'm taking you back to the United States. All by yourself you are? Or did you bring your friends? The friends from Cuernavaca. The man called Jack said, I have a lot of friends. But to tell you the truth, I think I'll do it all alone. Riley nodded almost to himself, seemed to think it over dispassionately, and then he charged. Not toward the man by the stairs, but in the other direction.
toward the building's edge. There was another apartment building next door, but that structure was separated by an alleyway 15 feet wide. The neighboring rooftop was one story lower, and Riley thought he could make it. He charged on, picking up as much speed as possible, knowing his one avenue of escape was a massive leap between two buildings, some 75 feet in the air. Jack Ryan Jr. thought he might be able to stop the man before he threw himself over the side of the 5-story building. He could shout something and run for him, either catch up or hope the man hesitated near the edge. But Ryan just stood there watching, while the Englishman leapt. The man kicked his legs and flailed his arms. Then he disappeared over the side of the apartment building. Ryan did not hear him land on the other rooftop. Instead, he heard a long, shrieking scream that grew more distant. He heard no impact, but immediately his earpiece came alive.
"Ryan, I saw someone fall. You okay?"
It was Chavez. "I'm fine. Did you see him hit?"
"Face down in the middle of the alley,"
Jack said. "No better than he deserves."
"Yeah."
Clark's voice came over the net now. "Works for me. Let's pack it up. If we leave now, we'll be back in time for Sam's funeral at Arlington." Ryan nodded to himself on the rooftop, and then he headed for the stairs. Epilogue. Adam could have flown on another plane, but the CIA wanted him out of China as soon as possible, and the next U.S. government aircraft to depart Beijing was the big white 747 known as Air Force One. President Ryan delayed his departure 2 days to make this happen, and it had been an interesting time indeed. The coup in North Korea took less than 20 hours, beginning with Hwang's speech to the North Korean people and ending with the reports on Korean state television that the Daewon-su had taken ill and was going to spend some time recovering in the mountains of his birthplace. The kid had been born in a hospital in Pyongyang, so it was anybody's bet where he was. But Jack Ryan didn't think it was anywhere good. It wasn't bloodless. Choi's bodyguards put up a fight, but they were up against the Chosun Inmingun, and it was a matter of hours, not days, before the tide turned and the power shifted in North Korea. The Chinese made it happen, all would say, and while the Chinese had great influence over the North Korean military and certainly controlled the media access that had allowed Hwang to reveal the scope of Choi's corruption to his own people, few would ever know America's role in uncovering the Chongju mine scandal or the effect a single American agent had in the affair. The rumor would come out that the Chinese had someone at the mine, and this would be helped along by an Australian geologist, who, back with her family in Melbourne, allowed that her intermediate knowledge of Mandarin played a small role in saving the Korean peninsula from a madman. Dr. Powers was just glad to be home. She'd keep quiet about the American agent, her ride in a remote-controlled aircraft, and her arrival at a U.S. airbase. The CIA moved Adam Yao onto Air Force One out of sight of the press and even traveling administration personnel. Almost no one on board knew that a man on a stretcher had been carried onto the aircraft after the curtains were closed. The only personnel aware were the CIA officers and medical staff who brought him from the embassy, along with 2 Secret Service agents who checked everyone extra carefully these days, even Adam Yao, though he was flat on his back with a bandage around his leg. For his part, Yao had been sullen since he'd regained consciousness in the clinic in the embassy. He'd responded to direct questions from his doctors, but he hadn't said much else. No one had even tried to debrief him yet. CIA had a serious protocol for debriefs, and the officer's health was paramount. Apologies were made to the Chinese that they couldn't speak to the man, but the Chinese had their hands full with the goings-on to their south, so they'd not made much of a fuss. Air Force One was well out over the Sea of Japan when President Ryan entered the medical office and sat down next to the injured CIA NOC. Adam tried to pull himself higher on his pillow. He couldn't have stood up if his life depended on it, and even though he knew it would have been respectful to do so, he also knew better than to try. But he did raise a weak hand with an IV tube running from it. Ryan said, "It's an honor to meet you, Mr. Yao."
"Likewise, sir."
His voice was weak, a result of the drugs and exhaustion, but he was aware. He looked over his president, the cast on his left arm, the sling on his right arm.
"Oh my gosh, are you okay?"
Ryan smiled. The kid had missed a lot of happenings over the past week. "I'm okay. And I'm told you are going to be fine. Little frostbite, broken kneecap, a laceration, a mild infection that should clear up in a few days." Adam just nodded. He said nothing else. Ryan thought he detected a problem. "Is there something bothering you?"
"I'm sorry for asking this, Mr. President. I don't want to sound ungrateful, but I have to know. Did we make some deal with the Chinese to get me out?"
Ryan did not hesitate in his response. "None at all. I added you onto the end of a deal that had already been made. A deal in both our nation's interests." He shrugged. "Hell, a deal that worked out for everyone. Ultimately, even the North Koreans, although I don't expect a thank you card and a tray of cookies anytime soon." Adam blew out a long sigh, utterly relieved. With a smile, he said,
"They would be awful cookies, I can guarantee that."
"That's good intel," Ryan joked, and he patted Yao on the arm with his cast. "Can I get you anything?"
"I have everything I need now. Thank you."
Then Ryan turned serious. "The work you have done has made an incredible difference. Huang is talking to us, and he made a statement that went out all over the world about the rare earth mine. It's hard to predict what will happen inside the DPRK now that Choi's gone. We expect chaos in the short term, but in the long term, we think it will have a positive effect."
"What about the foreign nationals working at the Chungju mine?"
Ryan said, "Huang has provided that information to us, and we will be passing it on to the Australians, French, Canadians, and others before he speaks publicly. These countries will need to appeal directly to the North Koreans. It's all we can do." Ryan added, "We cannot thank you enough for what you've done. You've sacrificed a lot." "It was my call that put you in North Korea. I knew when I complained to our intelligence execs that the human wasn't acceptable that they would redouble efforts to change that. And I knew that meant some young man or young woman would be going into harm's way. I don't take that lightly at all. I know it must be hard to appreciate that the old people running this country really do care about the young people they cajole into the dangerous missions. But I was there once. In your shoes. A long time ago."
"I know you were, sir.
And I hope you know I'm happy you sent me. I'm glad I got to make a little difference." Adam coughed, and Ryan got the impression he wanted to say something else. "What is it?" Adam said,
"I met your son. A great guy."
Jack chuckled softly. "Should I ask where you met him?" Adam shrugged.
"I wouldn't."
Jack let it go. Finally, he stood. "Get well, Mr. Yao. Your country needs you."
"Yes, Mr. President."
Jack Ryan went up to his office on Air Force One to make some calls. Andrea had come out of her coma, and she was talking now. She was due to fly back to the U.S. the next morning with her husband and young son, and Ryan wanted to speak with her immediately to thank her for everything she'd done. as much as he wanted to hear her voice. He knew she'd want to hear his as well, because even though she was in a hospital bed 5,000 miles away from her president right now, he was still her protectee, and she would feel the unease of not having seen him get to safety in Mexico. Ryan sat down at his desk with a wince, and he asked his secretary to place the call. While he waited, he looked at the photos of his family on his desk. He had a few years more to devote to his country, and then he would be able to give himself back to his family fully. And as he looked at a picture of his entire clan, he thought about a day when they wouldn't have to worry about the possibility of getting a call like the one Kathy had gotten last week. Ryan smiled. That day was coming. But then he looked at Jack Jr. in the photo. His smile faded. That day wouldn't come for Kathy so soon after all. His son had pushed himself headlong into danger, and danger had pushed back. More than once, this Ryan Sr. knew. He also knew that someday he might get the call that the husbands and wives and parents of all those Secret Service agents got last week, giving him the news that his son had been killed in the line of duty. And the thought of it utterly chilled him. So he did the only thing he could think to do. He shut his eyes and prayed for peace. This is Scott Breck. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tom Clancy, Full Force and Effect by Mark Greaney. This program was directed by Chris Kosheski, executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 2014 by Rubicon Incorporated. Production copyright 2014, Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.